Hi, everybody. This is Gregory Jones, your host of the Toncast. And my special guest today is television's Todd Robert Anderson. Say hello, Todd.
Hello, everybody.
The odd thing about this podcast, other than me being your host and having never done a podcast in my life or listened to one all the way through, is that I don't know who Todd is. Todd is not on the show. I'm not Todd, and Todd is not Todd, although it sounds kind of like Todd.
It is similar.
But he named Todd.
On the Film Pigs podcast, I think there's a guy named Todd who's...
Oh, that's right. I've heard on the Film Pigs podcast, I do hear this guy come in and do DVD reviews, or straight-to-video reviews, and he's pretty funny, but I've never seen him or met him, and he sounds a lot like you. Are you related?
Well, we're cousins. Yeah.
How are you, like, removed or?
We're 17th cousins.
Wow. So it's like Barack Obama and Lincoln, aren't they, like, 17th
cousins? It's exactly like that.
Right.
He is. The Lincoln to my Barack Obama.
So having never done a podcast, the first thing I wanted to talk about was what podcasts are and what they're supposed to be. Now, I came from the world of, I'm an actor, like television's Todd Robert Anderson. That's what I do for a living. And a lot of people who are listening will probably say, that is total bullshit, because how can you make a living being an actor if I don't know your name? But non-famous people can be actors too, right, Todd?
Yes, I'm proof of that. I'm not famous. Nobody knows who I am. In fact, I've been in the making a living as an actor for 16 years, and just yesterday I had a commercial audition, and the guy running the session didn't know who I was. Which was particularly depressing, because he knew who a lot of the other commercial guys were by name. He was very friendly. He's like, "Hey, Bill, what's going on? Hey, Evan, how you doing? All right, let's see who's next. Todd." And I was like, "Yeah, that's me. I've been in the business as long as all these other. Let's just do the audition."
But he probably hasn't been in the business as long as you. You know, so he's catching up.
Maybe
he's seen them on the whatever campaign, but not you.
That's true. Well, I'm, you know, I think the reality is I'm not a social butterfly in the audition waiting room. I tend to sit quietly and read.
Yeah.
But a lot of actors are outgoing social people.
Yeah.
So they.
I am generally. I mean, I don't. I don't want to talk about acting the whole time.
Oh God, I don't either.
Because most of the time when I hear actors talk about acting, I want to kill them.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
I'm kind of two personalities when I'm in a waiting room. Sometimes I will be the social butterfly because I know somebody there and we did a thing together and, you know, we say, "Hey, that was great. How's the kid and how's the wife?" You know, and you show the pictures on the phone. And it's nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's very relaxing. And I tend to have good auditions after that kind of experience because I'm just talking and, I'm myself.
Right.
Whereas other times all of that will kind of drain my energy and I'll go in and I'll sound like a Muppet. There are times when I'm like totally silent. I don't know anybody new in the waiting room, or the people that I know that we aren't really friends. We're just like, hey, John. Like we always see each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, good to see you again, but it's not really good because we don't really get along.
We don't see
each other, but it's like seeing anybody else at work, where you're like, hi.
Yeah, you have to be polite, but yeah, that's a good point. And ultimately, your competition is also, they're also essentially your coworkers, because when you do have auditions, you go to this place and you see the same people quite a bit, and you have to be polite. Some of them, I'm the same way. Some people I really like, and I'm sure some people think I'm a douche and other people think I'm swell, and but everybody's polite because you're in a work environment.
But when you're there, you never try to pull some sort of psychological warfare on anybody.
I do not, although people have tried to pull psychological warfare on me.
Like what?
You know, just trying to psych me out.
Like how? Like, oh, this part is perfect for me. Or, hey, this part is perfect for you. You're going to nail this. You mean like that?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, it's usually more subtle, I think. I'm trying to think of a very specific example. I mean, it doesn't happen very often, really, but usually what happens is, you know, I'll have a conversation with a dude who's going out for the same part, and then when he walks away, that's when I go, wait a sec. Was he messing with my head?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And it comes under the guise of fun, jokey banter, and then when they walk away, I'm like, eh, that seemed wrong.
Yeah, yeah. But sometimes I think maybe I'm just being paranoid, and the person who's like, hey, this part is perfect for you, actually is being sincere and is trying to be supportive, and I'm just a paranoid douche.
You know, it's probably a little from column A, a little from column B, yeah, in the end.
That's racist. So, so let's get off of that thing. Podcasts. I'm fascinated by the podcast because before you said you've been making a living as an actor for 16 years. I've been making a living as an actor for 6, which is a weird thing because we're the same age, but I didn't go, you took a more direct line to it than I did. So after college, I went off and did a bunch of things as people do in their 20s. And I know you did other things besides acting. But then I met my wife in like the late 90s and I had a job like for a, you know, an office or a PR company for like 6 years. When my daughter was little, she's now 10, but when she was teeny, it was like the wife was home, so I was very traditionally pulling down the bread, you know. And
right.
And then around 2006, it was that decision of, hey, I really, before I die, I really would like to give this a full go, like really dedicate myself to it and see if I can do it. Because then when I look back, in my old age, I don't want to go, oh man, I never really, I went to school for it. I had the skills for it, but I didn't have the guts to really give it a shot.
Yeah. I think that, good for you. One, cause you don't want to, have any regrets in life, you know? I mean, for me, that's sort of why I went, you know, my logic going into acting from the get-go was like, well, this is what I want to do, and it'd be easier probably to not. But if I don't, you know, at least try and fail, then I'll be, you know, it's, I don't want to live my life in a what if kind of place, you know?
Yeah.
What if I had done that? You know, because I think a lot of people do. And I think a lot of people, when they get out of acting school, because acting school is like a bubble of complete and utter nonsense, like both, you know, it's learning a craft and that's important, but it doesn't prepare you on any level for the realities of.
Yeah. Well, I'm told that they're doing that better now, but when we went to school, back in the early 90s for this, there was no industry sort of reality check before you left with your diploma. It was just like, hey, now you know the craft, go enjoy. And you and I walked out into the world and we got our knees cut out from under us, you know.
Right. And they also, I mean, the other thing is that, you know, where we went to school, they were method happy, they're group theater happy, Stanislavski happy, and there are a lot of other ways to approach acting.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important lesson, is to know that the method isn't necessarily the way to go for any given. It's certainly a great thing to know how to do, because in certain situations you'll need it. But not all acting involves that, you know. There's a lot of course, improvisation, you know, in commercial acting and TV and film now, that doesn't really get covered. And it's, I don't know. It's like, it just,
it taught one thing, I guess, well, which was how to, you know, use and understand the method from some level, but that prepares you for nothing.
Well, the way you're using the word method, I think, is wrong, because you're also lumping in some of the just basic tenets of Boleslavsky and those kinds of, you know, given circumstance questions in with the Strasbourg world of later on in the second half of the 20th century, when he was like, hey, to take this all the way, we have to get more immersed in our emotional life and in our memories.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
So Boleslavsky and Stanislavsky were not about the method. Strasbourg popularized something that movie stars started using in the 50s and 60s that became known as this thing, the method. But that's not what Stanislavsky was trying to do. He was just trying to give actors or a more scientific textbook for how you approach something, you know, which I think is a good idea.
That is a good idea. I'm not negating any of it. I'm just saying it's limited. That's all I'm saying.
Absolutely.
And
even knowing all that, and knowing improv and knowing Meisner work and all these other, you know, a lot of different terms for it, but knowing all those things, I would have loved to have somebody sit me down at least for 5 minutes and go, all right, listen, this industry is almost impossible, and you're going to have to make a decision about how much intestinal fortitude you have, how much you want this, because it's going to take an incredible amount of sacrifice, and you're going to fail every day. You're going to be told no hundreds and maybe thousands of times if you do it long enough. And you're still going to have to get up in the morning and find a reason to go to work.
Right.
You're still going to have to love it.
Yeah, and beyond that, the other thing, I mean, because I think as Americans, too, that's sort of a tricky thing for actors, because we're brought up to believe, you know, that if you believe in yourself and you work hard enough and you you're talented enough and, you know, all those things, that you can have anything that you want. And I mean, I don't think that's true about anything, really. But it's certainly with acting, there's so much luck, you know, involved, that those things. Basically, I wish someone had said to me, look, here, I mean, also to know how the business works, I think, helps, which nobody covered in college at all.
Nobody covers it. Nobody sits down and goes, listen, this is what casting directors do. This is what agents do. This is what managers do. This is how they all work together with the people who actually own the content, these huge mega media companies. That would have been great to just know the lay of the land. Like, this is, if you're going into any other business, you understand how what they call the supply chain. Man, I didn't know shit about that. I just thought I was supposed to hand my pitch and resume to people and do a monologue. I mean, it was so.
And that's another thing. When was the last time you had an audition where the person running the audition said, do you have any monologues prepared? That never happens.
Not since I've been getting paid for this.
No, it never happens. And that's the thing. They're like, you've got to have, in school, they were like, it was like school for ancient Russian theater. You should always have 3 monologues of varying types under your belt and ready to go at an audition. It never comes up. Never comes up.
Because they want to see, because whoever's casting wants to see you in something appropriate for what they're doing. Usually the actual text of the thing they're doing. That's all they want to see.
Exactly.
All right. Enough of this acting bullshit. I said we weren't going to talk about it, and we've already talked about it.
It's ridiculous. It's such a waste.
But actually, this is a good segue, because I was talking about I was trying to figure out as before when you asked me, hey, would you host this podcast? And I said, okay. I don't know what – I did some research on what podcasts are and who does a lot of them and who's famous for them. And as best I can figure out, a podcast enables you to make contact with many people – but connect with no one. Like, it reminds me of Facebook or Twitter in that way. Like, you can send all kinds of information out into the world in bytes or in podcast form. It's like usually half an hour or an hour. Send that out into the world, and you don't have to listen to the response. You just send it out there. There doesn't have to be any. There's no two-way. You know what I mean? It's just,
that's
my thing, and I'll deal with your bullshit later.
Right, right. And a lot of shows are like, there are shows certainly where it's just one person talking. The Smartest Man in the World with Greg Proops is an example of that. he does work with an audience, so there's that. But I think a lot of them also, you know, it's the, I'm having a conversation with this person and letting the world listen to it. Yeah.
Right. Like you and I are doing right now.
Yeah, exactly. And exactly.
We're betting, or we're thinking, or we're hoping that your listeners are going to find this interesting enough to download and put on their iPod when they're going to work.
Right. Yeah.
They're in the car or something.
Yeah, they're in the car or they're doing housework, you know, with the earbuds in, and they listen and they're like, wow, this mundane conversation is awesome.
So my question is, what is with this self-centered wave of communication that has overtaken us with this phase of the internet? Because the original phase of the internet was, hey, I can send email. Remember, that was the first, like, when we got out of college, we were the last, you and I are the last generation who did not have the internet when we were in college.
That's true.
Or our childhood. So then when we got out of college, suddenly in the mid-90s, there was this thing where you could send email, and it was so cool, and you could receive email. It was neat. It was like, hey, I can save a stamp. And then the big thing was like, oh, there are websites. You can go to websites and get information, do research on shit. Because originally it was set up as kind of a research arm of the government, of the military industrial complex.
I thought it was originally set up by the adult film industry.
Well, they used it. They used it to great effect. Maybe the porn people had some sort of connection with the military-industrial complex.
Oh, I think the porn industry runs the military-industrial complex. They're one and the same.
So, my theory about... And then this phase after that became... You have to have your own website. All actors now have to have their own websites to display themselves, you know, you are your product. But then this next phase that, as far as I've been able to discern, and tell me if I'm wrong, is this next phase is people with no marketable skills, or people who are too lazy to develop skills, can now just market their biographies, prostituting their personal lives in lieu of having any talent, and then showing and doing that.
Well, that's definitely true about me, but I don't know if you can make that kind of general statement about everybody who has a podcast. Excuse me.
It's not just podcasts, people who do podcasts, Facebook nonstop, people who tweet. There's a lot of the tweeting thing I'm still trying to understand. Essentially, what I can find from all of these communication devices is that you can really market yourself effectively. If you have something you can sell that has to do with media. I mean, obviously the media like to talk to each other via Twitter and pick up trends, quote, in quotes, from the Twitterverse. But anybody who's like who puts out their own shingle, like you and I, who are actors, or somebody who's a comedian, or somebody who's even a professor who wants to just like get their ideas out there, can use this kind of communication. But then there's this, what I'm trying to get to is there's like a reality show, contingent of people who really have no, skills, and they figure because of the technology that they have enough money to buy the technology to be able to do a podcast or be able to tweet or be able to make their own, little videos. And that is their product. It's now no longer that they have to have any sort of skill they have to hone and craft over a number of years. They just have to have the money to buy the computer and the laptop and the camera and the iPhone, and then they're in business. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know how much money podcasts generate for people. I mean, if you get enough listeners, enough hits, then you can sell advertising space. But you have to get pretty high up in the numbers. And I'm not sure, you know, what the secret is outside of, you know, having very popular, famous guests on your show.
Right.
Outside of that cachet, I you know, I don't know, you know, how you generate excitement. I mean, the there's two obvious ways. It's
let me just say one thing about that. I'm not saying that that people are making money doing this. I'm just saying that that is a way for people to use their time, is just to exist on the internet in podcast or Facebook or Twitter or website form or YouTube. And they're not making any money on it. They're losing money. It's a lost leader, but maybe they don't need to make that much money because they're living in their parents' house, or I don't know, they're collecting disability, or for some reason they're married to somebody who has money. I don't know. But then therefore that's their whole business. It's just the product is me. Like, for example, I was listening to Marc Maron, who, you know, he's one of these guys you were saying who actually can sell ads for his podcast now, because it's very well listened to. It's got a good following, right?
Yeah,
it's
very popular. Yeah,
right. He's had lots and lots of famous, but all of his comedian friends and other people in the entertainment industry are on his show, and it's a really good show. But then the other day, I tried to listen to some of it, and he spent like the first 10 minutes just talking about his like flight from Portland or something, and then he had a fight with his girlfriend, and there was this kind of this was the part I'm talking about where it's just like prostituting your own personal life.
Mm-hmm.
In lieu of actual content, in lieu of actual creative output, you're just kind of like talking about your day.
Well, I mean, he's a stand-up comic first before being a podcast host, and the way his stand-up comedy works is it's you know, stream of consciousness. He's not a set it up and knock it down joke guy. He's you know, a stand-up who talks about his personal experience. I mean, and I think that's what he's going for in the beginning of his shows, is sort of a little stand-up comedy opening.
Yes, that's the thing, though, is it doesn't sound like stand-up comedy. It doesn't sound, like you said, he hasn't set it up and knocked it down. He hasn't crafted anything. He's just talking, and it's full of self-loathing and all kinds of analyzable. I'm sure the guy's been in and out of therapy. And I don't mean to denigrate the guy. I'm just saying, that's not my cup of tea to listen to. And I was like, wow, this guy is one of these like really famous podcasters, and this is his content. Not all of it, but this is like what you're buying when you get pay the $2.99 or whatever for his premium iTunes thing is that personality. And that's not to me as I don't understand why that's valued versus somebody who took the time to like hone actual material. Now, I don't just mean comedy, but I mean anything where it's instead of listening to you and I talk about our kids, you and I could like get together and do a film. We could do a play. We could, you know, we could create something that has a reach beyond just the quotidian, everyday, you know, the now. But that's what good art is what I'm saying. That's what art is. It actually is. It creates a timelessness. And all the stuff we're doing here. Well, I don't even know if Marc Maron would call what he does art. I don't mean to pick on Marc Maron, but, well, fuck it, I'll pick on him. Who cares? He's never going to listen to this. but it's not art. It's just like the recycling. It's like, all right, I'm putting out the canister today, and let's dump it, and let's collect some more for tomorrow.
Well, yeah, that's modern media. That's talk shows. That's news. That's all that stuff. I mean, that's what it is. It's just incessant yammering without just whatever they can grab to fill up space in their medium. That's what they do. I don't know if it's meant to be art. It's just meant to be entertainment, I guess.
Well, I would never take issue with Kim Kardashian or somebody else for doing their whatever. I mean, that's the essence of like somebody who's like a reality.
I would like to take issue with all of the Kardashians. But go on.
But they're not even they don't even pose as comedians or actresses, do they? They're just themselves. That's their product.
Well, they pose as they're famous celebrities. That's their whole thing. They were like, they're basically born into celebrity, and that's what they do.
Right.
They
whereas Marc Maron is claims to be a comedian, and I know that he has material that he goes around the country and does, but then when he does his podcast, he's just a lot of times he's just talking, it's like self-revelatory. it's all just coming out of, this is my innermost stuff. And it's very, very personal. And I find myself, am I just old fashioned that I get very uncomfortable listening to somebody like him talk about his personal problems on a podcast, or seeing somebody on Facebook go, got divorced today, sad day, frowny face, on his Facebook update?
Yeah, I understand what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
Am I crazy? Does that just seem a little bit...
No, I mean, I don't post about my divorces and stuff on Facebook or Twitter. The most personal stuff I post on those things is, like when I have diarrhea and stuff.
So again, that's not, I don't want to know that. I mean, I love you, man. I always will, but I don't want to know about your intestinal tract. I really don't.
Well, it's just, I have really bad diarrhea today.
Well, why would you think anybody would be interested in that? Even your wife, that should be just maybe a top line sort of, hey, by the way, my stomach is kind of, but that's even for your wife. That's as far as I would go with that storyline.
I'm actually shitting right now.
Maybe Colby, maybe your son, you could tell him a little more. Because he'd be like, oh, cool, dookie, or whatever they call poo now. I don't know what they call poo.
Your impersonation of my son is spot on.
What do they call? I listened to his podcast. That was the best Tomcast that I've listened to. That was great.
Yeah, he was a good interviewer. It was very exciting.
It was a lot better than this one.
I don't have any problems with this one. I think you're an immensely negative person. But I think that...
Off that way. I didn't mean to come off that way, but if I come off that way, then so be it. I mean, what are you going to do?
What? Well, I mean, I think... Did you ever listen to talk radio?
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, I was going to get to that, is that one of the things I did in my stopovers before I actually got serious about acting was I did radio for like 5 or 6 years, different stations all over the country. Sports radio mostly, but also news talk. So I got to know the world of radio pretty well. And podcasts obviously have their roots. A lot of podcasts have their roots in talk shows. You know, I think some of the podcasts even, you know, they take callers, so to speak. They take email questions and they take, you know, tweet questions and stuff.
Yeah, a lot of them do. They're just basically radio shows. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. So what were you going to say about,
well, I mean, do you feel that having worked in radio and now explored, podcasts, you know, intellectually, as you've talked about them, I mean, do you feel that talk radio of, you know, now and before is more nuanced and it involves more than podcasts, or?
No, that's a good question. No. No, but I guess I give the radio broadcasters more slack because it's the inventory issue you were talking about. They have to fill the whole day, you know, so they pay guys or ladies to show up for 3 hours at a time and get on the phone and be like their personality and have people call in and go, yeah, Rush, I agree. Or, no, Howard Stern, I don't have anal sex with my wife because so that's not art either. I'm not trying to say that radio is so much better than podcasts are now. That's not true.
So you don't think that anal sex is artful ever?
It's a whole other type. I guess it could be. I guess it could be. Honestly, I've never had it, but I guess it could be.
You've never had anal sex ever?
No. I mean, except for right now we are. Should I have said that?
No.
Out loud?
No.
It's pretty boring anal sex, though, because we're able to have, like, a whole conversation.
Yeah.
While we're doing this.
And I have diarrhea at the same time.
And now the only person who is listening to this podcast has clicked. I've caught my limit. That's actually a good point. The more disgusting and we explore more taboos, the further we go with that, maybe we'll actually get people to talk about it. So they go, oh my God, somebody will go on Facebook today and go, oh my God, I was listening to this podcast. It's usually like a nice guy just kind of being cranky. And today they were talking about having anal sex with diarrhea, and oh my god, that was horrible. And then like 40 other people are like, oh my god, I have to listen to that. And they listen to it, and they repeat the same revulsion. And suddenly we're like known for, we kind of hit a little moment in the, what do you call that? The approval matrix, or the hypometer, where we're like, hey, those guys did a disgusting thing one day on a podcast.
We're like the human centipede of podcasts. It's just disgusting, and you have to watch, even though you know it's awful. Did you see The Human Centipede?
Oh no! You're getting into your kind of.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
No. Just know that it's probably a B movie that's really disgusting that you've watched.
Yeah, it's about a guy who takes three people and he sews them ass to mouth, and he calls them a human centipede.
Come on. I was having such a good time. And now we're talking about the human centipede.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to derail your show.
Your knowledge of B movies, especially horror and slasher films, or whatever the human centipede, whatever category that falls under, is will never be topped. So I think it's great that you do those reviews, because if anybody would know, you would.
That's it. Well, thank you, I think.
Let's go to a podcast, because I've kind of got a stomachache now. Can I ask you something? You mentioned movies. I think the number one problem tell me if you agree or disagree, the number one problem with movies that almost work, I don't think movies that are bad. There are a ton of movies that are bad, and they're never going to be good because they were a bad idea to begin with. That's the way most movies and plays, for that matter, and TV shows go. They were just a bad idea to begin with. They were never fully thought out, and then they were written badly, and then people didn't watch them, and then they disappeared. But then there are these movies that are kind of in the middle there. They actually have a solid foundation, like somebody creative made them, and they actually might have some really good scenes in them, or they have a fantastic performer who does an incredible job. But the movie still doesn't work because the tone is not consistent.
Oh,
that's my what I've noticed about movies that almost work is that the reason that they fall short is because the editor and the director at the end of the day have not done an adequate job of going all the way through the movie to see if the scenes are congruent. If from scene to scene, we're all in the same world all the time.
I think you certainly just described current, you know, the Apatow era of studio comedies, I guess you would say. I mean, I certainly think that's true about most major comedies that come out. And a lot of them are actually critically acclaimed, and I go to them and go, well, this movie was tonally inconsistent the entire time, and like one scene it's absurdist and silly, like a old Zucker Brothers movie, and the next scene is like heartfelt and sweet, like an Albert Brooks romantic comedy or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was actually thinking
about James L. Brooks, because he famously, and you guys did a film picks about this. He did Broadcast News, obviously, which is I went back and watched it again recently. It still holds up. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I mean, obviously, it's beautifully written and beautifully acted, but the tone all the way through is so well maintained that even the leaps that they take at the end, I never have a problem believing. Whereas James L. Brooks, you guys have chronicled this thoroughly, but his later films like How Do You Know, there are good actors in there. There's some interesting ideas. It's the same guy behind it. And yet, tonally, it's all over the fucking map.
Yeah, I think... Well, I mean, a lot of times in comedy films, too, there's a distinct lack of planning. There's a lot of going off the script. There's a lot of improvisation. And then, if you shoot a movie that way, you have to... When you cobble it together at the end, you ultimately have two movies and you have to choose between them. It's like a great example of this actually working was Caddyshack. I mean, they wrote a very specific movie, coming-of-age movie about a kid who worked on a golf course. But then they had everybody improvising, all these great comics improvising, and at the end, they had a three-hour movie that was half coming-of-age and half hysterical improvisation, and they...
I didn't realize that. They had a lot more footage of Danny just kind of going through his journey.
Yeah. And that's why he has, like, weird reshoots, because they're like, when they tried to cobble it together and just keep the, like, coming-of-age thing to keep the studio happy in there...
Yeah.
They shot a couple scenes to just wrap it up really fast so they can make room for Bill Murray and the Gopher, which was not on the page. That was not on the page. I mean, Bill Murray's character, I don't think, had any lines. And they only had him for, I think, 3 days or something crazy like that. And it was just Ramis just shooting Bill Murray for 3 days.
Right.
And then they, you know, built a lot of the movie around him ultimately. But I mean, I think when you're in the editing room, what you're saying
is that Ramis made a choice, though. At the end of the day, when he was in the editing room, he was like, "All right, you know what? The stronger stuff is all the crazy bits. So let's just keep those in, string together somehow, and throw out most of the young man's journey thing."
Exactly. And the young man's journey was, you know, supposed to be the heart of the piece, but it wasn't. I mean, the heart of the piece was just goofy comedy. And I feel like a lot of movies, especially you get these movies now that have, two-plus-hour running time, and it's a comedy. I don't get. But a lot of times they have both of those things. It's like they have a Caddyshack where they have all these crazy fun improv moments and silly bits, but then they also have the Danny Noonan, like, sweet thing happening, but then they don't choose. They actually edit them both together, and then you have a tonally, maladjusted story.
Don't you think it happens in movies that are not comedies, too, though?
Yeah, absolutely. I just notice it more in comedies.
Because I was thinking of, I just saw J. Edgar. You seen J. Edgar, right?
No.
Okay.
I don't know why I would see that.
You saw Gran Torino.
I did see Gran Torino.
Okay. So Gran Torino, I thought, worked. I really liked that movie.
Yeah, I did too.
Okay. That's a totally consistent film. It's not, I don't think it's the best picture of the year. Did it win Best Picture? No.
I don't think so.
But good movie. Really good movie. Because Clint keeps it consistent all the way through. And he's got this nice developing story with his neighbors and the whole cultural divide. Great. But J. Edgar is this, I may just start with the script too, but he had good people in it, and he's a good director, we know that, and yet the movie totally is all over the place. We start with a very serious monologue from Leo DiCaprio doing J. Edgar, and then the first shot you see of him is not Leo, it's Leo with all his, like, old age makeup on,
mm-hmm.
And immediately takes me to Billy Crystal. Still doing those, you know, from 20 years ago on Saturday Night Live or something. One of those, you know, old age faces, like really funny faces where it's obviously a young actor in old makeup.
Yes.
And then you flip over to Armie Hammer, who's one of the most beautiful men in the world right now, and he's wearing old age makeup. And I just want to go, come off it, guys. But the tone is, the score is like, and there's a little like plinky piano. Clint did his own score for this, which I don't think he did himself any favors.
He pulled a John Carpenter. Did it sound like this? Ding 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 ding. J. Edgar J.
That would have been an improvement. This is very plinky and slow, and the movie does not track like that. Like from scene to scene, shot to shot, it tracks more like a heart pounding kind of it's either a caper movie or like a thriller, because we're always trying to track something down, and we're always, Jager's always trying to, you know, he's on the case trying to, like, get somebody.
Mm.
But that's not the way the score sounds. And then the old age scenes are ridiculous because of the way they look, the choices they made with the old age scenes. And then the actors attempting to sound old and look old end up looking ridiculous. And it's really a shame because then there's all these wonderful flashback scenes where Leo is just Leo with a little, like, I think a little prosthesis maybe in his chin.
Mm-hmm.
And Army is just beautiful Army. And they're having these great scenes together, really beautiful acting. But it all comes to naught because they kept this other stuff, and Clint didn't have his editor didn't have the guts to tell Clint in the editing room, dude, this old age stuff is just going to kill the movie. Anyway, that's my little beef about tone.
Yeah. That might also be, reaching it feels like to create what he wanted to create was out of his reach or any, I mean, if it's out of Eastwood's reach, nobody can accomplish it. But it is that old age makeup never really works.
Yeah, it was just the choice they made, and it did, and when they looked at the rushes, I wish they just gone, no, this just looks ridiculous. I mean, this is one of the most famous attractive movie stars in the world, and we got him in this big hunk of junk on his face, and it's gonna make people laugh or cringe. And that's not where you wanna be.
No, you're right. That isn't where you wanna be.
Let's go from movies to TV for a second.
Mm.
What's gonna happen to reality TV? Now, you and I are both union actors, so I don't want this to sound like, hey, we're these union guys who do scripted shows, and we're all pissed off at the reality TV world because they use non-union talent, and I don't really give a shit. I mean, you know, the marketplace is the marketplace. It's all going to sort itself out, but I'm curious what's going to happen to reality TV, because the shows have gotten so extreme. They've tried to film more and more extreme sort of circumstances.
Oh, like Hoarders and what's that one where like really weird addictions or something?
I don't know that one.
It's one where like it's like weird, strange addictions or strange extreme addictions. Like one woman eats like she likes to eat like dryer soft fabric softener sheets. Yeah. She eats that, and then a guy is in love with his car. Like has. It's really weird.
So I have a friend who will go remain nameless who's who produces reality TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
His opinion is that reality TV is going to hit a threshold very soon where they're going to have to just cop to the fact that they're fully fictional, because now they've got people doing such outrageously unreal things to keep the audience interested that they're blatantly setting up, in many of the reality shows, setting up all of the staging, all of the stories, essentially, to make it engaging from commercial to commercial. And eventually they're going to have to just go, you know what, it's not reality TV. We said it was real, but it's really not.
Mm.
But now that you know that, now we can go even further. Because the only way you can go even further with what they have right now is to fully fictionalize it. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I totally know what you mean. I mean, that's interesting. I was wondering, you know, I wonder myself where it's going to go. I guess that's what you could do. I don't know. I kind of equate reality television and its evolution to the evolution of pornography in a lot of ways. Because,
how so?
Well, it's like my friend Skelton, Steve Skelton.
Yeah.
He said to me one time, he's like, you know, remember when it was really hard, you know, to find porn? It wasn't just online, you know. And when we were kids, you know, and you found a porn movie and it was like, what, you're just watching people have sex. It's like, whoa. And then you remember the first time you saw someone like do someone in the butt, you know, you were like, oh, what? Where did he put that? And then by the mid-90s, if there was an anal in a porn scene, you were like, what happened to the anal? You know? And now it's
keep going further, right?
Well, now it's gone off the rails. It's like reality television with the weird addictions. It's like, you know, they have names for it, like gaping. Like who who wants to see a butthole that open, that close? I mean, why is that a thing, you know? And like girls drinking milk out of each other's like privates, you know, filling themselves up with milk and then spraying it. It's like, who had that idea? Why is it becoming commonplace? It's disturbing. It's disturbing, but it's because, you know, like reality television, it's so much of it exists according to, you know, shock value and sort of prurient interests. And there's only so far you can go with each thing. I mean, once you've seen enough people having sex, it's in order to keep you engaged, it's got to get weird.
Yeah.
You know, I've logged 10,000 hours of people having sex. So now someone needs to put it in somebody's butt or I'm going to be bored. Right. And then another 1,000 hours, 10,000 hours later, you're like, we should fill these women up with milk. You know, it's like, Why?
It's like who's the guy who wrote Blink and Malcolm Gladwell? It's like Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000-hour rule.
Mm-hmm.
What makes you an expert in something? 10,000 hours of porn makes you an expert in pornography, and then you, and then once you reach that black belt level of pornography exposure, you have to, like you said, you have to raise the bar, or the provider has to, the content provider has to raise the bar.
That's true.
Otherwise, you're going to move on to, I don't know, another hobby.
I don't know what else there is.
Besides watching porn.
Is there more to life? the 10,000 hour thing is an interesting concept, because at this point, I am certain that I've logged at least 10,000 hours of rejection.
So you're an expert.
I'm an expert in rejection. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got at least 5,000, I think.
Yeah, you're on your way. You're on your way. Pretty soon you'll be up here with me at the top of the pile of rejection.
You get a special place out by the dumpster. So, let's talk about, since we're talking about porn, let's talk about some other taboo subjects, because what I was really interested in is a lot of ways that people on radio and in podcasts now get buzz, is by saying something really outrageous, right? It's the same thing we're talking about. It's the same sort of rule as the reality TV or the porn thing, where you have to keep raising your bar in terms of outrageousness. Otherwise, people will just switch the dial. And in terms of saying things, Rush Limbaugh always has proved, he's proved very reliable in saying more and more outrageous things.
Mm.
And even though he lost sponsors the last time he said something ridiculous, I think about that law student in D.C. or something being a slut. Even though he lost sponsors, in the end, I think I would argue it helps him with audience, because people are like, oh man, I gotta listen to that. He's saying such crazy stuff.
That's true. I mean, I don't know, with the right-wing pundits, that's an interesting thing. I mean, I think people listened to Rush Limbaugh for not so much because he says outrageous things. I think it sounds outrageous to the left, but I think his listeners are not listening to him because he's outrageous. They're listening to him because they agree with him. It's not like Howard Stern's more outrageous and says,
I don't know. I would disagree. I would say that he is an entertainer first. He's trying to stay on the air. He's trying to keep his numbers up, and he will say whatever he has to say to his right-wing audience to light their fire. And obviously he's feeding them red meat all day, but if he can, the rarer and bloodier he can make the meat, the more entertaining he will be. And therefore he calls whatever that lady was, call her a slut, and that she's a prostitute for wanting birth control and all that. And that's a way, because it enrages the left, and it also enrages people who have common sense and decency, but his listeners are like, yeah, that's awesome! You know, and they love him, they're with him. I mean, I would say his, in that way, similar to Howard Stern, the way Howard Stern used to be. Now Howard Stern, he's kind of his nether region of satellite radio now. But in the old days, remember, like, on a monthly basis sometimes, it'd be like, what did Howard Stern just say on the radio? Remember?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh my God, he said that on the radio!
But do you think that the Rush Limbaugh's right-wing audience has that reaction? Oh my God, I can't believe he called that chick a slut, as opposed to, yeah, she's a slut. Thank goodness someone's saying that. I feel like that's more what his audience is doing. I think he's more of a shock jock to the people who don't listen to him than the people who do. I guess that's my point.
I don't know. I think the people who say, oh yeah, I always thought she was a slut, I think they're being disingenuous. I think he really is continuing to try to be entertaining to his core listeners. And even my 103-year-old great-grandmother-in-law in Illinois, who loves Rush, had never had the thought that what's-her-name was a slut. But hearing Rush say it is so satisfying, because it's like, oh my gosh, he said that. And, you know, she's a church-going, she's a nice old lady. She's a sweet old lady.
Mm.
But that's a wonderful, it gives her a wonderful little high of like, oh man, he just said that out loud. I really do think there's something to that. We're going to disagree about that, I guess.
No, I see what you're saying, though. I take your point.
But let's talk about what I was wondering is if you and I can get in trouble today in some really outrageous way and then therefore get attention.
Well, I wish my mic cord was long enough I could take it, you know, into the bathroom and record my next bout of diarrhea.
No, that's not what I was. No, I don't want to do that. So this is my problem. I'm either too repressed or too nice, depending on your point of view, to go all the way there with a taboo subject, because I instinctively pull back from you talking about your bowel movements. But I will talk about race. I was thinking about race, money, or abortion. Those are three topics in addition to porn. That probably more. Those are probably more taboo than porn at this point. Almost everybody talks about.
Can you make a horrible statement about all of those at once? You know, I think all minorities should have their pregnancies aborted and give me their money.
Dude, I'm gonna tweet that right now, and you're gonna get like the biggest listenership you've ever had. I think we shouldn't have abortion because the next aborted fetus in the country might end up being a really famous black person, like the next Obama. And then where would we all be? That's another way to tie those three together.
Wait, what are you saying there that you think? But you said you made a pro-life argument. Right. But because you want minorities to do better.
No, I was trying to make an outrageous pro-life argument, which I totally disagree with. I was just trying to say something that tied all three together. But yours was.
I think mine was way more offensive.
You think it was more offensive?
Yeah, because you just said, maybe I misunderstood what you said, but you said, I think abortions should be illegal because the next fetus that is aborted could have been a great black man.
Right.
That's like a.
That's just kind of sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually a good argument for pro-life.
Pro-life, but I don't want to make a good argument for pro-life because I don't. That's not my personal. That's not my belief.
But I thought you were trying to say something outrageous, regardless of your belief system.
You're right. It's not outrageous enough. I'm trying to figure out another way. I don't have to do them. Can we do them separately? I don't know if I'm clever enough to do them all at the same time. All
right. Yeah.
What if there were a really rich person? What if you charged rich people more for abortions?
I think we should charge rich people more for everything.
For everything. It's like taxes. Their taxes have to be higher. They should pay more for gas at the pump. Rich white women should pay more for abortions than
poor black women. The way we do that is we get rid of cash altogether. Everything's on plastic. And you have to register as a rich person.
Right.
Or a poor person. You know, you just put your income level there, and then you get charged according to that. I think that's a good idea.
But it's all on a curve, right? So somehow the card or the chip in the card knows, or the system that you swipe to knows, okay, this person is at this income level, and therefore they get this graded price for the latte, as opposed to the rich person.
Yeah. And
you might pay like $1 for your latte, whereas the rich person has to pay like $7.
Right. And if you don't have a job and you have no income, everything is free.
Including abortions. See, I was trying to find, you know, I was just trying to figure out a way to, because, you know, we're not famous and we're talking on a podcast that no one listens to, but if we were, then people would... And if we said anything about race, in some contexts, if you say anything about race that even touches on race, you can lose your job. You can lose your livelihood. You know, it's incredible how that's still the case in 2012.
Yeah, that's true. I you know, it's interesting, the political correctness of our times, but I actually don't think that's a bad thing. The only time I run into trouble is when that I get agitated, I guess, is when it's just a statement of fact, you know, It's like I was telling a story about where the night Colby was born, and it was when we got to the hospital, it was Friday, but then, you know, it was the middle of the night, so it became Saturday, and there was a Hasidic Jewish man on the other side of these glass doors. And I was on one side, and he was, like, waving at me, and the glass doors were electric, and you had to press a metal button to open them, and he was pointing at his button, you know?
He can't do that because it's his Sabbath, so he can't
right.
break the machine.
But my wife was going into labor 2 months early. It was the middle of the night. I was exhausted, confused, shell-shocked, and this guy's on the other side of these glass doors pointing at this button, and I didn't put two and two together, and I really wasn't thinking about him, and I pointed the button at my side and sort of nodded at him to let him know, yeah, that's, you have to press the button to open the doors. You know? And he looked back at me and, like, got agitated. He's like, no, you know, he's beckoning at this button. And we went like that for a while before I realized what it was. But when I tell that story, it's like Hasidic, you know, as soon as you say, you know, because I'm not Jewish, the story involves a Hasidic Jewish man. As soon as I say that, people get tense. Like, is this guy going to say something horribly anti-Semitic? And like, I was telling a story at dinner the other day, and my own wife stopped me because I was like, yeah, so, because I was telling a secondhand story that I'd heard on a podcast. And I was like, it's a very funny story about a Mexican gardener. And she's like, whoa, 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 what is this? And I was like, No, it's not a comment. It's not a racist thing. He was Mexican and he was a gardener. I mean, it put her on edge. So that's where I think maybe it goes a little too far. But if somebody says something overtly racist, I think it's fine that they lose their jobs. I mean, freedom of speech and all that, but there's so many things you can say, not just, I mean, it's like if you have a show and they have advertisers and you make an offhanded comment to, you know, about Jell-O or something and Jell-O's a sponsor, then you're going to get fired. Yeah. You know what I mean? You just, when you're in that sort of situation, you just have to be careful. But I don't think, certainly saying things that are racist and hateful, I think it's kind of nice that people get fired, actually.
What about people who are so famous, though, that everybody's trying to get a video of them doing something silly or racist or drunk and then make themselves famous by putting it or humiliate them by putting it online?
I see what you're saying.
Their entire lives in this state of fear that they're going to be humiliated publicly, even though they're just trying to live their lives. I'm not trying to reference David Hasselhoff or Miley Cyrus, but both of those videos arguably are not, I mean, who really gives a shit? You know, he was drunk and eating a burger. She, I don't know, was she licking a penis cake?
I don't know. I missed that one.
I think she got a penis shaped cake for her birthday.
Oh, right. And because she's like a Disney girl, that was a big deal. Yeah, I think that's uncool. I mean, the Hasselhoff video is different because it was his daughter that filmed him and leaked it to humiliate him, to get him to clean himself up.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
So that was, it was humiliating and awful, but it was his daughter who did it. So I would argue that's an act of tough love. As far as Alec Baldwin's like thing, like being rude to his daughter, I think that was kind of unnecessary to leak that, and it had really no effect ultimately on his career. As far as Gibson at this point with all his leaked stuff, I mean, it's horrible, and I feel bad for the people who involve themselves with him, but at the same time, yeah, I think that's private business. It's not anybody's business. So I see what you're saying.
I would disagree though about the Hasselhoff daughter thing, because if you really love him, why don't you just show him the video when he's sober another time instead of showing it to the world? Because now it's like his entire career and image are tied up with this 5 seconds, these 5 minutes of horribly sad behavior. And why would you want to have your most horribly sad moment of behavior filmed and known to everybody for all time? It just seems like a totally out of balance with, obviously if she wants him to, I don't know the story, but you do, she really wants him to clean up. I think that's a wonderful goal. I think she could have gone about it in a way that was less damaging to him.
I don't disagree with that, but I only know that part of the who. Maybe she did film him and try to show it to him, and maybe nothing changed.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know all the details. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like where Alec Baldwin's losing it, and you know, calling his daughter a fat little pig or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's abusive language, and it is inappropriate. But at the same time, everybody has, you know, slips of the tongue. And maybe she was being a horrible, horrible shit.
Right. And we don't know the whole, we're not them. We don't have their, we don't know the inner inside of their relationship. So you can sit back and you can always sit back and judge. But I do agree that the gotcha, aspect of filming or recording somebody doing something, shitty is serves a good purpose. For other scenarios, like public servants, you know, when politicians do or say something, that's hypocritical, counter to actually the way they represent themselves publicly. I think that's good to get that out there. I agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
You know, you gotta talk the talk. Hey, what happened to Generation X, Todd?
We turned 40.
Generation X turned 40 this year, and I'm wondering, as a generation, at the time, I remember thinking we were special. Did you feel that way? Did you ever feel like you were part of a generation that had a name?
I took no pride in the name Generation X. I mean, Generation X, it was a novel, and it was terrible. And it's a really bad novel. But it got famous, and it was very derogatory about us. And the thing is in a lot of ways, you know, the stuff that we our particular generation was up against is, I mean, we started when this country was in an awesome place economically, and we've watched it go down the tubes. Unfortunately, I think for the most part, it's got nothing to do with us. It has to do with, you know, the generations before us being irresponsible.
Yeah.
And kind of saddling us with a bad situation. But I never liked that term, Generation X, and I never, because I was never, a sit back and do nothing. That was sort of the thing, you know, that's the, we're apathetic. And cynical, to the point where, you know, we're just gonna sit around and do nothing and live off our parents' money and stuff like that. And
that was the stigma, right? It was that Generation X was, we were a bunch of, we were like the do nothing product of the boomer generation. And we were just going to coast off of the fact that every generation previous in America had done better than the one after, one before it, so we were going to be fine. That was the negative side of the Generation X thing, right?
Right. Well, I mean, and that's what the point of the book was. So, it was a very negative portrayal of our generation, and people responded to that. We were just goddamn kids. We hadn't been given the opportunity to show anything beyond that, and I don't think that stereotype was particularly fair.
Well, it also is a strange. It's in the end probably just a meaningless media assignment to say, "Oh, this group that was born at roughly in this period, late '60s, early '70s, is Generation X," because I think it's very different than boomers, because boomers you can point to an actual statistical change in the number of births in America after World War II. Okay, I get it. That's who they are. And then, of course, they've been assigned all these different identities over the years, because there's so goddamn many of them. Hippies, you know, sexual revolution, and then swingers, and then selfish Wall Streeters,
mm-hmm.
You know, and then what you said, you know, conspicuous consumption destroying the planet. My parents, by the way, were born in 41, and they weren't involved in any of that. Were your parents boomers?
No, and they weren't.
They were too old.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. But they weren't, yeah, I mean, they weren't hippies. They, even if they were, you know, of that generation, they didn't take part in any of that stuff.
But that was a very, I understand why they have a name, the Boomer Generation, because there actually was a baby boom. Whereas our generation, it's a very easy, and again, kind of a lazy media assignment to say, well, they were born in this period, and they grew up in the 80s, and America was awesome then, and we didn't have to do anything for ourselves, and our parents were really had a lot of money. What distinguished them? Well, there was this guy who wrote the book about them. There was grunge came of age when they did in the early 90s. They were, I believe this is right, we were the generation at that point that had the highest, our parents had the highest divorce rates.
Yeah. Hey, hold that thought, Greg. I'll be right back. Right back.
Todd is actually leaving the podcast in the middle. I thought actually I was making pretty good sense there, and he just got up and left. It's a little disconcerting. I'm going to try to ignore that and not take it personally. But while he's away, I should say a couple things about him. I really like him a lot. I think he's a great guy. I wish over the years I've gotten to spend more time with him because I just think he's funny as hell, and he's also a brilliant, creative person. Not just as an actor, but he's a brilliant writer, and just a, you know, an eccentric thinker, which is a good thing. He's also uniquely self-loathing, which I identify with, and I think that. That may be also a mark of our generation. Of course, again, I don't know if the whole idea of trying to assign different values or different themes to your generation or traits is even an errand worth taking, because we're, depending on where you grew up and when you, and how you grew up, you're going to be different than other people who were born at the same time as you. So it's a very generic and kind of insulting way to just group some people together for no reason.
Hey, sorry about that. I drank so much coffee before we started this, and I've been holding that piss for so long, I had to go.
I was just talking about how articulate and brilliant you are.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'm sure.
Way with words, and then you came back and started talking about how... like elevate this conversation, and you keep bringing it back to the.
Sorry, that was I had to take a leak. Anyway, you were saying.
Christ! Time. I try to do something that has merit. You just wipe me right back down to your asshole.
I didn't make a diarrhea joke. I took a leak. It was my pee hole I brought you to that time.
That's just semantics. Don't try to make me feel better.
It's not semantics, it's anatomy.
So, what I was thinking about, and now that we've kind of exploded this myth of what Generation X is, because it really is nothing. I mean, depending on where and when, where in the country you were brought up and under what circumstances, you're not going to be the same.
Yeah, you make a great point. Baby boomers, you know, What is it? The Great Generation or something like that? The World War II?
Or if people went to World War II.
And that's named, that generation is named after the Great World War. And the boomer, and, but we're named, that's what agitates me. We're named after bad fiction.
Because then, and it's, the other thing about that is we're not really a definable group. It's just a kind of a random way to say, well, those people were born in that time period. We have to call them something. But the people who were born after us and came of age during the internet, they have a very specific, you can assign a real tangible, cultural change to their childhood. They grew up with screens in front of them nonstop and with the internet in their lives at school and at home, and it totally changed the way they communicate. It's a huge difference, whereas we did not have that. We basically had the same communication means that our parents did. So in a way, I feel like we are the oldest young people in the world. I don't have any of the innate internet and computer skills that people who are younger than us have. But yet we have to deal with all this technology now because that's the way the world works. Maybe that's why sometimes I feel so out of touch with the way people communicate now, because I wasn't brought up that way, Todd.
No, and it's very interesting, and you make a solid point. And people, we there's so much communication now that is one-sided. It's basically our communications have become about providers and consumers as opposed to two people talking. I agree with that. That's well, interesting.
But it's not even. Yeah, it's
And we are in it. We are in born into a weird thing where we saw the dawn of this new technology and the internet and all that stuff, and we are the last generation that, grew up with rotary telephones.
We're the last dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And the internet is the asteroid.
Yeah. And so much of what we grew up with is antiquated well before, we were even middle-aged. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like when we were kids, an antique was, grandma's rocking chair that she'd had for 75 years. And then by the time we were 30, those old phones that you see in all the 80s movies...
Yeah.
With the rotary or the big buttons.
Yeah.
Those are antiques. Those were antiques before, we were out of our 20s.
So we're sort of antiques.
I guess. I guess.
Our sensibility is just different, We just have a different way. We're, in a way, I feel like I'm just a little bit off.
Well, and on both sides, I think. I don't think it's just that we're looking... We're so alone, both that we couldn't relate to the people who were older than us, and we can't, we're in this weird place where nobody quite understands what the hell it is we've gone through. Does that make sense? So it's not, we're like, the people who are older than us are like, well, I don't understand what the hell they're going through. And then the people who are young, we're walled off as this weird generation that's been through something completely different than anybody else's, but it's not defined except by, the evolution of technology, I guess.
Yeah. And now, therefore, it makes me have this really adverse reaction to technology's effect. We're having this conversation on a podcast, and the podcast is taking place via Skype. So we are using technology right now. I'm also aware of, I go to New York City every day for work, and people now on the streets, I would say more than half at all times are walking along either by themselves or in groups, but they're all looking down. They're all quiet and they're looking down and they're thumb typing.
Mm-hmm.
While they're walking. So it's like this, it's kind of like zombies just ambling down the sidewalk, and you have to really be careful when you're walking so you don't run into them because they're not looking where they're going. And they're thinking, they're in this other place that's in their screen. They're thinking about whatever they're typing about. They're not thinking about where the hell they're going. People are run over regularly now in Manhattan because they're not fucking looking where they're going. They're thumb typing instead of watching the don't walk sign.
Well, this might be natural selection at work. I don't know. But I will say, as an iPhone, I have an iPhone 4, and as an owner of an iPhone, I gotta say, they're very addictive toys.
Yeah, they are. They can be very handy.
Yeah.
But this sense of like, I gotta get in on that. That's what all those things create. The phone, the laptop, whatever you have with the iPad, whatever the tablet is, whatever it is, you gotta get in on it right away. Whenever you're not doing something, you have a moment to think. Instead of just standing there like a doofus like you used to in the post office line,
mm-hmm.
or in the bank, you don't have to stand in line at either of those places anymore, by the way.
No, you don't.
But anywhere where you actually have to wait for anything, God forbid you do. But if you do, all right, let's say the airport. You still have to wait at the airport.
Yeah.
this feeling of, God, I gotta look at this little screen because something might happen that will be a vast improvement over where I'm actually sitting right now is a very powerful, because a lot of times it's probably true. I mean, if you're sitting there, you know, and all you can, you're sitting there and the Cinnabon is across the hallway in the airport, and there are kids running around trying to play hide and go seek, and they're tripping you, they're annoying you, or somebody's like changing their kid on the floor right in front of you, and you can see all the, and then there's somebody going squawk, 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 in the flight is delayed, Robert, on the loudspeaker, and then Wolf Blitzer is right overhead with the TV. The actual place where you are can often be very hard to deal with. So this escape of going in here and being like, I'm here now, I'm inside this little, this world, this tiny world that's infinite. I'm in here. That's so secure, as opposed to actually dealing with the world around you and like finding someone.
Can you do the voice coming through the loudspeakers again?
Anderson, your seat has been sold to somebody more attractive.
I like the garbled voice. I see what you're saying. It's actually really interesting, but and also it is a fear of missing something. It's sort of like old, like in high school, you know. Every weekend, some jackass parents went out of town, in my town anyway, and so everybody, if I was sick, or, you know, my parents were like, no, we gotta do this, so you can't go to that thing, I would be like, God, what am I missing? This could be the most awesome party of the world. And there were no awesome parties. It was high school. They all sucked. They were all boring. You know, you only went for a couple hours, you know, and if you stayed the whole time, it was out of fear that something awesome would happen. And nothing ever did, you know. I mean, unless a bunch of teenagers getting their buzzes on is incredible. But it's that, like, mentality of, I don't want to miss anything. And it's sort of amazing. And, you know, and I'm worried about it too. Cause, you know, especially, you know, as actors, we're like, the next phone call could be the call that changes it. You know, it's, you never know and you don't want to miss it. But at the same time, you know, sometimes I'll just leave my phone inside and go in the backyard, you know, and just put my feet in the grass and stare at the sky. And the birds and stuff. And that sounds really corny, but it's like, wow, there's a lot of shit going on out here. And it's nothing. It's birds and squirrels and planes flying by and cars, but it's kind of, you know, it's kind of nice just to do that sometimes and not worry about missing anything.
I walk my dog. That's how I get my time away from the internet. I walk my dog. It's the same thing. It's just, you see birds. There are a lot of deer up here. We see deer running around. You see squirrels. The dog smells all these. He reminds me of those, these awesome smells that I'm not really appreciating, like poo and grass smells awesome. There's like moldy crap in the ground. He smells that. He loves that. There's like garbage that he loves to smell. And then once in a while, I'll walk by somebody who sits. I kid you not. They're sitting in their car. The car is parked. It's on. And they're in the driver's seat typing on their phone.
Mm.
And I don't know how long they've been there or how long they're going to be there, but they're like burning gas, sitting in the car. They're probably waiting for somebody to come out or they're waiting to go into somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They're out in the world and yet they're in here instead. They're inside the little cocoon. And to bring it all back around to where we started.
But before you do that, it's actually, I had a thought.
I'm going to tie up the whole thing in a beautiful bow and you're going
to
just.
But this might add to your bow. Fuck off. You asked me to do this interview and now you're giving me attitude. But I was just thinking, because I think I housed it wrong. That going out in the backyard, you're. So you can't get your face out of the phone because you're worried about missing something. But the fact is what you're missing is all the stuff that's actually going on around you. You're so worried and staring at this phone that's providing ultimately nothing, no real news, that you're not out and you're missing, it sounds really corny, but you're missing the birds.
Yeah.
You're missing planes flying overhead. That's cool. Planes are still cool. I turn into a 5-year-old when I see planes go over. I'm like, that's awesome. We can fly, dude.
That's actually an interesting point. The difference in the standards have been raised, I think, for this generation that grew up with the internet nonstop and screens all around them. Their standard of their interest, the threshold where afterwards something will be interesting to them is much higher than it was for us. Because we could go, I could just get on my bike and go ride on my bike all day when I was a kid, and I didn't have any TV time, nothing. I just like dug in the dirt and rode my bike with some other people, and that was it. That was all I freaking did. And now kids, I have a 10-year-old kid, and she's great, but she watches too much TV. She needs to check her email. She needs to get on the computer, and there's some interactive game she plays or something. But there's this sense of, that's boring. I don't want to, you know, I'll go out with Hannah somewhere just to like the backyard, or we'll go to a ball game or something. And if there's not something immediately entertaining her at that moment, she gets bored. And I'm like, well, you know what? Maybe the outside world is not here to do a show for you all the time. Maybe the entertainment today will be you and I just talking. Or maybe it'll just be feeling the breeze as we're sitting here watching this ball game, or it'll be watching the ball game, or it'll be, I don't know, watching the planes go over the stadium, whatever it is.
Right.
But the threshold for her interest level is higher than it is for me. I'm interested in much less interesting things. I can watch a tree, you know, like you were saying, I'd watch a tree and the breeze go through it, and I could be interested in that for a while, you know, if I allow myself to be, as opposed to going, well, I'm looking at the tree, but I really have to get back to my, I wonder if somebody's going to respond to my blah, 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 blah.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. So I was going to tie it all back around now, but I can't remember what we started. Oh, we started with what's the meaning of a podcast. Yeah, it's just we covered it. It's just the sense of needing. The programmers feel like they have to entertain you constantly and feed you more and more, like the reality TV thing we're talking about. And therefore, the audience becomes accustomed to being stimulated at a more frequent level, a more intense level all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take a walk outside and you're like, man, this is not nearly as entertaining as that half-hour program.
Reminds me of an old Bill Hicks bit where he's like, you know, you watch your TV and it's like war, AIDS, starvation, but then you look outside your window and it's just like crickets and trees, and you're like, where the fuck is all this bad stuff happening?
I'm missing it.
There's nothing out there.
All right, we're gonna end on Bill Hicks. I gotta go walk the dog.
All right, well, thanks for having me on your show.
That was great. I really enjoyed it. It's always a pleasure to host this for the first time. And I've always been a big fan of the pigs and listening to you guys. You are my number one podcast you're the only podcast I actually put on regularly. If I'm like doing something intensely boring, like cleaning the floor, whenever I have to like scrub my toilet or clean the floor, you guys are the first thing I think of.
Oh, well, thanks.
I want to see some more vlogs. Where are the vlogs? Are you guys not doing video vlogs anymore?
Well, we haven't done them since, I think the last one we did was Ghost Rider 2. But one of the film pigs, well, it's just, you know, life. Because we don't get paid to do it, and it's essentially a hobby, life gets in the way. And Steve was very, very busy. And to be quite frank, there weren't really any movies that we were excited to see. So we just didn't. But we're going to go see The Avengers. That'll be...
You are going to see The Avengers.
Yeah, we'll vlog The Avengers.
Awesome. All right, man.
All right.
I'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, and... Do you thank podcast listeners?
It's your show.
Okay. Well, if you're still listening, it's been a pleasure taking up this time. I don't know how Todd's going to cut this together, but if it doesn't make any sense, it's probably his fault. So I take none of the blame. I'll take all the credit. And it's just been a real pleasure to just talk in a very uninformed way about a lot of things that I'm interested in. Bye.